More crime may mean more crime fighters in the Bakken. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us why Montana continues to fight the federal Real ID program. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with state corrections officials about some new initiatives in the state's prisons. But before our top stories tonight, we have this breaking news. A federal judicial panel investigating former U.S. District Judge Richard Siebel over a racist email involving President Barack Obama found the judge sent hundreds of other inappropriate messages. The Judicial Council of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals found emails that showed disdain for blacks, Indians, Hispanics, women, religious faiths, and some with inappropriate jokes about sexual orientation. The council's March 2013 order reprimanding Siebel was released for the first time today for the Judicial Conference of the United States. Siebel retired May 2nd before the order was enforced. The Ninth Circuit Council condemned Siebel's email practices and ordered he issue a second public apology. It says concerned parties may ask him to recuse himself. Two council members said they would go further and ask Siebel to retire. An FBI spokesman says the agency is considering permanent agents in the Bakken oil patch as the drilling boom drives crime rates higher. That sparked a dispute between the state's U.S. senators over where the agents should be located. Crime on both sides of the Montana and North Dakota border has spiked as thousands of new workers arrive with drug traffickers following in their wake. Since July, two agents and an intelligence specialist have been stationed in Sydney. North Dakota Senators Heidi Heitkamp and John Hoven want the agents moved about 45 miles northwest to Williston, North Dakota. Montana Senator John Tester wants the agents to remain in Sydney. FBI spokesman Kyle Loven in Minneapolis said today that a final decision will be made by FBI headquarters. A Colorado man charged with killing an Eastern Montana teacher has been returned to jail following a lengthy evaluation to see if he's fit for trial. The Richland County Sheriff's Office said today that Michael Spell had returned to the County Detention Center from the Montana State Hospital in Warm Springs, where he has been since November. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty in the 2012 killing of Sydney teacher Sherry Arnold. Attorneys for the 24-year-old defendant say he has mental disabilities that render him unable to understand the case against him or assist in his defense. State District Judge Richard Simonton has ordered the psychiatric hospital to complete Spell's competency report by January 31st. Co-defendant Lester Van Waters Jr. pleaded guilty under a deal with prosecutors. He's awaiting sentencing. Also from the area, a Montana woman has pleaded guilty to a drug charge in a case that resulted from a law enforcement crackdown on trafficking in the Bakken. 33-year-old Jenny Lynn Britt of Sydney pleaded guilty to conspiracy to distribute methamphetamines during an appearance yesterday before U.S. District Judge Susan Waters. Britt faces a mandatory minimum of 10 years in prison at her May 14th sentencing. Authorities linked Britt to a trafficking ring that distributed drugs in Sydney, Fairview, Billings, Big Timber, Columbus, Livingston, and Bozeman. Under the terms of a plea deal, government attorneys would drop additional charges of possession of meth with intent to distribute and possession of a firearm during a drug trafficking crime. Prosecutors also will recommend sentencing reductions because Britt accepted responsibility in the case. And in other news from around the state, firefighters are crediting a man with saving the lives of a woman and her 5-year-old son when he spotted a house fire while driving into Kalispell. Chris Earlbeck tells the Daily Interlake he noticed a glow behind the house near Smith Lake at about 7:30 a.m. yesterday. The back of the house was on fire. Earlbeck said he knocked on the back door and the front door and went inside and yelled to see if anyone was home. He finally heard a woman yelling. He found her, she grabbed her son, and they all got out of the house. Smith Valley Fire Chief D.C. Haas says the woman and her son were sleeping, and if Earlbeck hadn't stopped, quote, it would be a very different story right now, end quote. Secretary of State John Kerry says he won't be pushed into making a decision on the long-delayed Keystone XL pipeline, despite pressure from Canada and other pipeline supporters for quick action. At a joint appearance today with Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Kerry said he has not received a crucial environmental report on the $7 billion pipeline, which would carry oil from Western Canada to refineries in Texas. Kerry said a lot of questions have been raised on the 1,700-mile pipeline proposed by Calgary-based TransCanada. He said the questions require answers. Kerry said he, quote, can promise our friends in Canada that all the appropriate effort is being put into trying to get this done effectively and rapidly, end quote. The State Department has jurisdiction over the pipeline because it crosses an international border. Governor Steve Bullock is asking the Department of Homeland Security not to penalize Montanans for using their state-issued driver's licenses as identification. Gradual enforcement of the federal Real ID Act begins Monday, and Montana is one of 15 states with IDs not in compliance with the law. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says this means Montana driver's licenses will start to get declined in more and more places with federal oversight.
We don't need a national ID card, and we don't need more data being collected.
That's Governor Steve Bullock. He sent a letter today to Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson objecting to new standards set forth in the federal Real ID Act. This 2005 law sets certain federal security standards for both state-issued IDs and the buildings and employees who issue those cards. It also requires state databases obtain standard photos from these licenses that will allow law enforcement to use facial recognition technology to help apprehend criminals. The Montana legislature unanimously voted against complying with the law in 2007, and Bullock opposed it both as attorney general and now as governor.
We continue to say that we have one of the safest IDs in the nation. We've taken solid steps to improve the security of the driver's licenses.
Enforcement of the Real ID Act unfolds in four phases for non-compliant states. Each phase includes more places where a Montana driver's license won't work as a valid ID. The first one starts really narrow, declining Montana's IDs in restricted areas of the Department of Homeland Security's main offices in Washington, D.C., but it ramps up from there to nuclear power plants, to most other federal facilities. The last one is the kicker. The law says no sooner than 2016, Montana driver's licenses would be declined as a valid ID to get on a commercial airplane. Governor Bullock expects the state to work out its differences with the federal government before then. The Real ID Act also does not prohibit the use of other acceptable IDs like a U.S. passport. The Department of Homeland Security declined an interview for this story, but the agency's website says secure IDs are a vital component of the country's overall security strategy. It quotes the 2004 9/11 Commission report in saying, "For terrorists, travel documents are as important as weapons." I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A tribal judge has dismissed a lawsuit by members of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes who wanted the tribe to distribute to its members all of the $150 million it received under a federal settlement. The CSKT Tribal Council in 2012 voted to distribute just over half the money the tribe received under the Salazar settlement, which was paid for by the federal government's mismanage of assets and natural resources it held in trust for the tribes. Members received $10,000 each, and the Tribal Council put another $72 million in an investment account. A group called the People's Voice sued, arguing its members have a property right to the entire proceeds from the settlement. Tribal Judge B.J. Jones ruled this week that the Salazar money was clearly not intended for individual tribal members. A federal judge has sentenced a Blackfeet woman to 3 years probation and ordered her to pay $50,000 in restitution for her role in a scheme to embezzle from a program for troubled youth. U.S. District Judge Brian Morris sentenced 53-year-old Charlotte Newbrest yesterday in Great Falls. Newbrest was the administrative assistant for the now-defunct POCA Project, a federally funded program meant to help Blackfeet children with severe emotional disorders. Prosecutors say the program's leaders and consultants stole an estimated $195,000. They also are accused of embellishing and making up tribal contributions to make sure the federal money kept flowing. Newbrest previously pleaded guilty to aiding and abetting theft from an organization receiving federal grant funds. Five other defendants are scheduled for a March 10th trial. Scientists at Washington State University are treating a 3-year-old female grizzly bear that has been suffering seizures. The bear is named Lucy and comes from Montana Grizzly Encounter in Bozeman. The bear came to WSU yesterday after suffering two grand mal seizures last week for no apparent reason. Since then, she has become more aggressive and lethargic at the same time. Scientists at WSU conducted an MRI evaluation of her head and neck, looking for a cause. The bear will undergo a complete examination and diagnostic workup. Art, musical instruments, Gilded Age furniture, and rare books from a reclusive copper heiress's private trove will be auctioned this spring in New York City. Christie's announced the plan today for about 400 pieces from Hugot Clark's collection. Clark was a daughter of U.S. Senator William A. Clark. He was a Montana copper and railroad baron who founded Las Vegas. Christie's says the total collection is expected to fetch more than $50 million. Highlights will be on public display at Christie's London in late January, then in locales in Asia and at Christie's New York base in April. The full collection also will be on view in New York just before the sales. Clark died at 104 in 2011. A feud over her estate was settled this fall. A Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton bound for the Smithsonian Institution is set to arrive in Washington in April as a new home is built for the specimen on the National Mall. The National Museum of Natural History announced today that the T-Rex, unearthed in Montana in 1988, will arrive in the nation's capital April 15th. The Smithsonian is planning a new 31,000-square-foot dinosaur hall that is scheduled to open in 2019. On April 28th, the museum will close the current fossil hall to begin a complete redesign and renovation. But Museum Director Kirk Johnson says dinosaurs will continue to be on view during construction. The museum has unveiled a new display featuring a cast of the T-Rex skull. Next year, the museum features fossils from the dinosaurs' last days. Madison County officials have released the name of a 28-year-old man who was killed in a rollover crash on U.S. Highway 287 just south of Norris. Sheriff Dave Shank tells the Bozeman Daily Chronicle that Garnet P. Ragone of McAllister died in the crash at about 1:30 a.m. yesterday. The Montana Highway Patrol says Ragone was northbound when his pickup truck drifted off the road. He overcorrected twice and the pickup rolled. Ragone was ejected. The patrol initially said the victim was from Belgrade based on the address on its driver's license, but Shank said Ragone had lived in McAllister for some time. A 19-year-old Billings man has pleaded guilty to deliberate homicide for beating and stabbing his great-grandmother to death during an argument. The Billings Gazette reports Robert Allen Thompson entered his plea for the July 19th death of 77-year-old Shirley Lawrence during a hearing today. Prosecutors plan to ask that Thompson get 75 years in prison when he is sentenced on March 27th. His public defender is free to argue for a shorter sentence. Charging documents said Thompson was staying at Lawrence's house and killed her during an argument that began when she suggested he get a job or, quote, he was going to be just like his father, end quote. Thompson was arrested the next day in Denver while driving Lawrence's car. Oregon State Police say officers in Montana have captured a man suspected of faking his death in a fishing accident 15 years ago, just before he was due in court in Southern Oregon on child sex abuse charges. The police identified him today as 55-year-old Daniel Clement Chafee and said he was arrested 2 days ago in Bozeman. He was accused in 1998 of rape, sodomy, and sex abuse of two teenage girls. Police say they identified other victims. He was due in court in Douglas County in September of 1998, but didn't show up. A police statement said a friend from Washington State told authorities Chafee fell from a fishing boat on the Snake River, but a search failed to find him, and investigators considered him a fugitive. This has been a busy time at the Montana Department of Corrections. Agency officials say they're working on a variety of projects and initiatives, while at the same time maintaining day-to-day operations. In this first of a two-part interview, Edward O'Brien speaks with Corrections Director Mike Bautista and Department of Corrections American Indian Liaison Harlan Trombley about a variety of issues. Trombley is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet Tribe. Both men toured the Montana Women's Prison in Billings this week. Bautista explains why they toured the facility with the State Tribal Relations Interim Legislative Committee.
We actually started out the week, went out to the Crow Reservation to meet jointly with the Tribal Relations Committee and leaders of the Crow Nation. They were having a joint meeting. We were one of the participants, along with many other people. They had a pretty full agenda, but they asked us to kind of give an update on some of the things that we're doing at the Department of Corrections as it relates to Native American and Native American programs. And it also gave us an opportunity to introduce Harlan and talk about the work he'll be doing for the department.
And we'll be talking about all those in just a moment. But generally, you think it was a pretty productive meeting?
Yeah, I do. I do think it was a good meeting. I had spent some time when I was with the Department of Justice on all of the reservations talking about and learning about their public safety needs. I thought the meeting was good. It gave us a chance to talk about not only the Native American population in the correction system, but also some of the programs that we are working on that will help with Native American successful reentry back to their communities.
Mm. Mr. Trombley, I know your job is basically to provide cultural awareness to agency staffers, but what does that mean? What do you do?
Basically what I do is I put together a cultural awareness training curriculum that's for, like you said, all correction staff and other department staff, which includes like the pre-release centers around the state, the treatment centers. Basically, it's just letting people know about the Native American heritage, the culture. For instance, the sweats and smudging that Native Americans do, just kind of the background of that and why the Native people do that.
And also eye contact is another thing, right?
Yeah, a lot of that is like the Native American people, they don't like to make like direct eye contact. They think of that as being disrespectful. And it may, for staff, prison staff, it can make them think that they're maybe, for instance, lying or not telling the truth, just trying to educate the staff.
Yeah. How big a difference can a little thing like that make? Let's just take the eye contact. Can that really snowball into a bigger deal than it has to be?
I think it can, you know, especially with if you don't know why people do that. It can change their perspective on how the Native inmate population, you know, how they kind of present themselves.
Yeah. And what can sweats and smudging do for a tribal inmate?
I think it can help with like their spiritual life, can help with the way they think, can kind of lead them to, I guess, go in a positive direction with their life, you know, not only inside the correctional facility, but once they get out.
So it helps center them a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Batista, what's the history of this liaison position? What circumstances led to its creation?
Well, actually, the position has been part of the Department of Corrections for a number of years. When I first took over as the director of the Department of Corrections this January 7th of a year ago, the position had, shortly after I started, the coordinator position had become vacant. The coordinator had moved to a different state. So we were in the process of evaluating some reorganization things within the department and adding some additional responsibilities to the position. And long story short, that's ultimately how we came to hire Harlan. He is also responsible for attending job fairs and recruitment of potential Native American candidates to the Department of Corrections. He has a number of things in the works. The department has a history of doing that, and we'll continue to do that and present what we think are some employment opportunities for qualified Native American applicants.
Mr. Trombley, granted, you haven't been there all that long. What, 2 or 3 months, is that right?
A little over 2 months now.
A little over 2 months. What have you noticed? Was the cultural divide pretty expansive between the Native inmates and the white staffers, or is it exaggerated, or what?
Well, I think, you know, we do need, there's very little of Native American staff, but, you know, like the director said, trying to attend all these career fairs will hopefully, you know, will help the department and also the state.
But is there a cultural divide?
I don't really think so. Mm. You know, like I said, just trying to get more people hired.
And you also work with families of Native inmates, right?
Yes.
What do you do?
A lot of recent calls that I've received from families, a lot of them, they don't understand the criminal justice system, why their family member that may be in prison or a community correction center, you know, they don't know the procedures. So a lot of it is just giving them that information. And a lot of it is just taking the time to listen to them. A lot of feedback what I've got is thanking me just for listening to them.
And you've been in law enforcement for some time, haven't you?
I have. I worked with the Blackfeet Tribal Police for a short time as a police officer. Then I went to work for Cascade County, their adult detention center, regional prison, as a correctional officer and case manager, unit manager.
I'm just curious, how'd you take that path for a career?
Well, basically, my family lived here, lived in Great Falls, you know, and I just kind of just wanted to change, you know, something stable. And, you know, I worked almost 11 years with in Great Falls. When this position came available, I just wanted, a change in my career. So I thought this would be a good career change.
Do you enjoy it? I would imagine it'd be very tough work.
The job I'm doing now?
Yeah.
It's a tough field. I think as long as you separate your work from your family, and as long as you have the support of your family, I think that helps out too.
And do you, if you don't mind my asking?
I do. My wife, she's very supportive of what I do, and I think that plays a big part.
I'm curious, how do other Native inmates view you when they first meet you? Do they question your loyalties and your motives, or do you think they embrace the opportunity to work and talk with a brother of theirs, if you will?
So far, I've been touring a lot of the facilities in Montana and talking with the inmates. A lot of them are glad that this position is filled. A lot of them I know from working in Great Falls at the regional prison. Some of them, a lot of them already kind of know who I am.
And the others, do you have to win them over sometimes?
Well, I think just, like I said, introduce myself. I'm trying to set up regular meetings with all facilities, like monthly meetings where I'm made available, every month. I think by doing that will help too. It'll kind of give me, a more positive rapport with all of them also. It's a lot of traveling, but I'm excited and so far, I've enjoyed this job.
Mr. Batista, we've all heard these numbers that American Indians are 7% of Montana's residents, but make up 17% of offenders supervised by Montana's correction system. Is that just the byproduct of poverty and high alcohol and drug abuse rates on the reservations, or is it something else?
Well, I'm not sure I know all the factors that lead to that percentage. I mean, obviously, us, the department being at the back end of the criminal justice system, we have very little say in who comes our way in either secure facilities or community corrections. But I think all the things that lead to people entering the correction system, I think there are a lot of similarities through all of our offenders. I think that, certainly alcohol and drug abuse contributes to a lot of the problems that offenders have that we see in the correction system. It's estimated that, 93% of all the offenders in our system at some point have had a drug or alcohol problem. That's speaking generally about all offenders. I think economics, poverty come into play when you're talking about Native Americans as well as just the general population of the folks that we see in our correction system. So I think the same issues apply to almost everyone that's in the general population.
On Monday, Montana Department of Corrections Director Mike Bautista and American Indian Liaison Harlan Trombley discussed the agency's desire and efforts to diversify its workforce. Now for this weekend's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with patchy freezing fog and lows 18 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies with highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. And on Sunday, it should be partly cloudy with areas of freezing fog in the morning and highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. In central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect from 5 a.m. tomorrow to 11 a.m. Sunday for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, expect sunny skies with highs 45 to 55 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 45 miles per hour. And on Sunday, it should be partly cloudy with highs in the 40s. In southwest Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And on Sunday, it should be partly cloudy with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Sarah Howell.
love Election Day. When I was a kid, I loved Election Day because our elementary school gym was transformed into a hub of activity, full of strangers ducking into and out of fabric booths. When I was old enough to vote myself, I loved knowing that many races and issues I would vote on were decided here in Montana by just a few hundred votes, making my vote particularly important. I loved Election Day when I lived in New York City, where you vote by pulling a big metal lever. That lever made a very satisfying clunking sound, as if it were connected to a chute somewhere that would drop open and send the candidate of your choice sliding into office. I love the late night waiting for election results, glued to a television, refreshing the feed on the Secretary of State's website over and over and over. And I was so excited to vote in the 2012 primary when I took my three-month-old son into a fabric booth in an elementary school gym in our own neighborhood and passed on the family love of elections for the first time. I love Election Day. So I take it very seriously when decision makers want to change how we vote. Last year, legislators placed two issues on the ballot. These are called legislative referenda, or LRs, and they're each given a number. LR 126 would dismantle our Election Day voter registration system. LR 127 would change our primary election system to what's called a top two primary. Both are unnecessary and bad ideas. Montana's election system is something we can be proud of. It protects our freedom to vote and makes it possible to have our voice heard in our democratic process. But 126 and 127 would change this system, attempting to fix something that isn't even broken. Let's start with LR 126. 126 would end our system of Election Day registration, something that has worked well in Montana for nearly a decade. Election Day registration is a safeguard that means if you find yourself unregistered on Election Day, whether by error, because you moved, or for any other reason, you're still able to register and vote at the same time. This is particularly important for seniors, veterans who have served out of state, people who live in rural Montana, low-income folks, and others. So imagine that back in 2012, you moved. You go into the DMV to update your driver's license and update your voter registration at the same time. You walk away feeling proud for taking care of business and don't give it another thought. But come Election Day, your name is not on the voter rolls. Maybe there was a computer error. Maybe someone somewhere misspelled your last name. For whatever reason, you are not on the rolls, despite updating your registration. In Montana, Election Day registration is the safeguard that protects against exactly this situation. You are still able to go down to the county elections office, fill out a new voter registration form, and vote at the same time. Now for LR 127. 127 would end Montana's existing system of primary elections. Right now, when you vote in a primary election, you decide which party primary you want to vote in, Democrat or Republican, for example, and then you vote for candidates competing in that primary. The winners of the primary go on to the ballot for the general election and voters choose between them. Often, we have three or more candidates for a single office in the general election because primaries aren't limited and voters deserve that choice. 127 would create what's called a top two primary. That means that only the top two candidates from the primary elections go on to the general election ballot. It takes away our independent voice by limiting our choices in the general election to just two candidates. And as if it isn't confusing enough already, it repeals so much existing law that it will be tied up in court for decades, costing Montana taxpayers millions of dollars. Montana's election system works well. We have one of the highest percentages of voter turnout in the country. Montanans take pride in a system that allows everyone the chance to voice their opinions and have their vote counted. LRs 126 and 127 are unnecessary, costly, bad ideas. When the time comes in November, we all need to exercise our right to vote no on 126 and 127. I'm Sarah Howell with Montana Women Vote. Thanks for listening and have a terrific weekend.
Sarah Howell is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.